cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, this story, it is another of our most read on the Bloomberg today. It's about how the era of economic whiplash is just beginning. Although, Katie, as you said earlier, I'm like, haven't we been living through
this? I feel
like
I've been whiplashed for like 2 years straight now. So I'm interested about this one. What does the future hold?
Could be a new round. All right, so let's get more on this Bloomberg Opinion column today. Here is Bloomberg Opinion columnist Eduardo Porter. He covers Latin America, U.S. economic policy, and immigration. He's the author of American Poison, How Racial Hostility Destroyed Our Promise, and more. He joins us here in studio. All right. Katie said, like, it does feel like we've had a ton of whiplash already this year. So what are you writing about?
Well, that's true. The whiplash that I think economists are detecting today, with the labor market going in one direction and the economy, the GDP, going in another direction, stems from what's been going on for the last 2 years, right? We got whacked by a momentous shock that we had never seen, COVID. Then we're coming out of that one, and we're whacked by this massive energy shock, which is Russia's invasion of Ukraine and all that's happened since then. And so a lot of what we're seeing, with the data seemingly pointing in different directions, I think ultimately stems from these events and from kind of like our reactions to them and businesses' reactions to them, and of course the government's reaction to them with a big fiscal stimulus in 2020 and 21.
So what does the fallout look like? What does the next whack look like?
Well, the next whack is coming from the Fed, right? Mm-hmm. In one direction or the other, and I think that's what's moving the markets most. Because the Fed is trying to read this. So the Fed is kind of sitting there and looking at an economy that looks kind of like crazy weak suddenly, and a labor market that does not look that crazy weak, and inflation that's been running very hot, but suddenly in the last 2 months seems to be, you know, stabilizing somewhat. And it has to, and in reading this, the possibility for error is very large, right? It could, I mean, I've heard now people fearing over-tightening. And so I think that that's where we will see the next big mover, right, of the economy.
Well, there's this line in your story, and I know you've kind of hit at this already, but I want to go back to it. Like you say, these shocks, these crazy shocks, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right? It's unbelievable, and we don't really know what it all is like on the other side. But I love how you word this. They might also tell us something real, rejiggering economic relationships in a way that will complicate the policy response. So is it just a case of data not reading things correctly, or is it the relationships of one another? Because as you say, it's like we get something on the labor market that's weak, and then we get something on the labor market that's strong. Like, it's very difficult how to square all of this.
I think there's the easy part is that there is some data issue. There is some mismeasurement out there. So the fact, for instance, that GDP and GDI, which should by definition be the same thing, are looking very different in the data, gross domestic investment and gross domestic product,
right,
is a data mistake. It's a data error. And
are you saying somebody in the government, in terms of the information they got in, made a mistake, or are you just
saying? No, no. I think the data that is used to, okay, to construct these indices is, I think, particularly noisy.
Okay.
And hence you end up with these two numbers that should be roughly the same number, and they're really diverging in a big way. So that's the easy part. The more difficult part is, okay, we were accustomed to, when the economy is strong, we see employment rising. When the economy is weak, we see employment falling. And now we're seeing these relationships kind of like a little bit turned upside down. So that's where you wonder, okay, how has this relationship changed? Mm-hmm. And still, of course, I think that over the long run, it's true. In a weak economy, employment's going to go down because businesses are going to start, you know, letting people go and stuff. So over the long term, I'm sure that these things still hold. But maybe there's new lags in the system, you know, because mm-hmm. we were trying to hire last year, but we weren't finding enough workers. And so we're really, really, really trying, and we pull too hard. And now demand is soft, but we're still pulling.
Right.
Right. So there's new, maybe new lags, new kind of whiplash effects that somewhat change how these things work together.
And let's talk about how long-lasting that change is, whether that whiplash and that change in behavior becomes permanent. I mean, at the tail end, if you look out far enough, do you see, you know, the economy, relationships with businesses, between businesses, sort of returning to normal, or do you think these will be some permanent changes?
Look, I'm kind of conservative, so my guess is that we do go back to a normal that roughly looks like the normal that we had before. I don't see, you know, the earth is still a sphere, you know, but there are some things that might be different forever. And one thing that I point to in the column is, you know, for instance, this idea of working from home. Working from home is going to stick around to some degree.
I hope so. Yeah, go on.
So, right? I mean, so many workers want that. And in fact, some businesses like it. And so that is going to be a permanent difference, that some share of the workforce is going to work from home. And how is that going to affect the economy? Well, that could go in several ways, too.
Right. Hey, Eduardo, just got about 20 seconds, 25 seconds. Does, though, this whiplash increase the chances of a Fed policy mistake, just quickly?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it does because, you know, the data, you know, the Fed is used to knowing in which direction to push. Maybe, you know, the question is, do I do it harder or softer? But you know whether it needs to cool it or it needs to, you know, not cool it. Now there's right. stuff in the cooling and in the not cooling direction at the same time.
If you think about how many things were miscalled, I feel like, in the last couple of years, like, you do wonder about what you're saying and how it makes it very tricky on the other side. Eduardo Porter, economic policy and immigration columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, right here in our Interactive Broker studio. Check him out at Opinion on Twitter. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the Bloomberg Big Take, also among our most read on the Bloomberg today, it's about how Harvard's longtime status as the wealthiest school is now facing an oil-rich contender, Katie.
An oil-rich contender in none other than the University of Texas. I don't know if you've heard, but energy prices have just been soaring this year. This is a really interesting angle into it, sort of from the endowment perspective. Janet Lauren wrote this story. She's in the studio with us. Janet, walk us through why this has been such a boon for the University of Texas in particular.
Well, I'm going to take you back to the 1800s.
Okay.
When the state of Texas began setting aside land for a public university system. Flash forward, the land ended up being in West Texas, where they said, perhaps you can get some money from grazing rights. And then what happened 100 years ago? Oil struck. Permian Basin today is the largest oil-producing region in North America. And given you know, what's been going on with oil prices, the war, and also a different strategy over the last several years run by University Lands, which is a division of the University of Texas system, that increased production and higher oil prices, add up those two things, and you get more than $2 billion in revenue. Now, what's really key about that is it goes into the endowment. And as we've talked about, many endowments are expected to have investment losses for the year that ended in June. So that gives these endowments, this endowment, some real liquidity when others are facing losses. They, that really helps them, you know, build their endowment if they're able to, you know, chase, you know, chase managers, good in, good deals in a down market.
Can I just, the first line of your story, every day the University of Texas system makes about $6 million off a mineral-rich swath of land it manages in the U.S.'s largest oil field. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, well, 2.1 million acres in the Permian Basin.
So compare that then now with Harvard, right? That was the headline on the story.
So right now the difference is about $9 billion. And given, you know, this year many schools are going to have losses if they have a decline in their value. Texas may have an increase in their value. Plus, if they're able to, you know, get some great investments. Plus, you know, the reserves on their land are, you know, the size of some publicly traded companies. And we're not even talking about wind and solar, which is, you know, they have great positions for wind and solar. So
because of all that land, right?
Because of all that land and where it's located.
And so compare and contrast what we're seeing in how other universities are managing their endowments. Because you're right, at this time, you see a lot of other universities pulling back from energy, sort of in an eco-conscious push.
Absolutely. In fact, Harvard announced last year that they were moving away from fossil fuel investments. So they're letting things rolling off, and they're not making any new investments. And a lot of schools are saying they're doing the same thing. But of course, as you know, private equity is a long-term investment. So you're not just going to yank out of a fund if you're in year two out of 10. And energy, as you noted, was a great investment this year.
How does it change? I mean, exactly, by a mile. If you look at the major 11 major industry groups in the S&P 500, energy up, I think, 43%.
It's nuts.
It's nuts, and easily beating all of the other 10, if you will. Will it put pressure on the others to maybe slow their roll, if you will, in terms of not being so environmentally conscious? Like, I do wonder at some point, right, does someone, we talk about this generally in ESG, great when the market's going up overall with everything, but when it's not, how many people are like, yeah, maybe I don't have to be so ESG conscious?
It's a really good question. And the other thing with Texas is these are not investments they're making. They're not buying into funds. This is just land that they control and they get the money, and it's just cash coming in.
Right. So it's not like they're going to go sell it.
What? Yeah. What a great hedge.
Well, and their hedge is actually wind and solar.
Yeah.
Plus, there's new things in the climate bill. So if you are a private company and you're looking for tax credits, you know, for carbon sequestration, if you're injecting carbon into a well, mm-hmm. there's another revenue stream.
So that's really interesting that they can kind of play it from both sides. That okay, we have these fields that we're generating a lot of cash from as energy prices and oil prices skyrocket. But again, to your point, they also have the wind and solar. So again, it's really a neat balance there.
How much of that hedge, how much of that oil, solar and wind, how much does that bring in for
It's not a lot right okay. now. It's like $5 million. But compared to 10 years ago, it was like $500,000. Mm. So
A little perspective in terms of anybody who's in the oil industry will say we're a boom and bust industry. I mean, is this just a really great year for them?
It is a really great year. But as we explained in the story, oil doesn't have to be at $100 a barrel to make money because, you know, they get 22.3% royalties. And they're not putting any capital expenses into drilling. They just sign the leases and get the money.
Right. So they don't have to the actual costs and stuff. They just lease out the land.
Yep. They just have the land.
A really fascinating story. And as we said, it is among the most read and really is so, I feel like, reflective of our environment today and really the move up when it comes to energy. Janet, thank you so much. It's also the Bloomberg Big Take, the reporting by Janet Lauren. She's our higher education finance reporter at Bloomberg News here in our studio. Check out all of her stories on the Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com and also on Twitter at Janet Lauren, right? Like I think about just those mm-hmm. macro trends that impacts so much.
And it really just speaks to this very interesting moment in ESG, whereas if you've been sitting in an ESG fund, you've missed out on that big energy boom. Obviously, endowments are feeling that as well.
No, really.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
A really good point.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the new Inflation Reduction Act includes new funding to help fight tax cheats, some $80 billion over the coming decade. Yep, it's a big amount, but still may not be enough to repair past damages to the agency. So let's get to this story featured in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week out later this week. Bloomberg News congressional tax reporter Laura Davison with us on the phone from our Washington, D.C. bureau, and Business Week editor Jill Weber with us on the Access line in Massachusetts. It sounds like a lot of money and that it should fix everything, Joel, but I guess not.
It is a big number for sure. And yet the surprising part, as Laura points out in the story, is that because of the past decade of cuts and also sort of normal attrition due to things like retirement, it may not really be enough. The other that I find really interesting, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, is, you know, this really gets down to, like, this is how the government funds itself, right? And right. There has been a huge aversion to actually, like, giving the IRS the resources it needs to do that. And yet, you know, that's not a light switch. You can't turn that on overnight. So Laura, walk us through these numbers. How meaningful is this number, even though I know it's a little bit of a wet blanket in terms of, like, it's not going to instantly change anything, right? But it is not nothing.
Yeah, correct. I mean, $80 billion, you know, just for context, this amount of money will be spread out over a decade. So, you know, kind of roughly about $8 billion a year, you know, on average that they'll get. The IRS's regular budget, you know, is somewhere around $12, $14 billion. So it's a really big number. But what they've got to spend this on is a lot of what is essentially deferred maintenance. They have computer systems that date back to the 1960s. They have a lot of employees that they're going to need to bring in and train. The IRS has about 80,000 employees kind of at the height of the tax season. They're expected to lose 50,000 of those and over the course of the next 5 years due to retirement. So
have they heard of TurboTax? Have they heard of AI? Have they heard of, I'm just saying, I can't believe their computer systems back to the 1960s, Laura. That's amazing.
It's really incredible, and it's been a huge problem. They've really had to kind of cut any sort of business modernization, computer modernization, as they had their own budget cut over the past decade. So a lot of this is now just coming to roost, and they're really having to look at they have more work, outdated systems, and employees that are about to leave that will take all the knowledge with them out the door.
So 50,000 employees in the next 5 years. Where are most of those losses coming from? Where are they going to have to hire? What kind of departments are we talking about?
It's really, I mean, just because of, you know, that 50,000 number out of 80,000, it's really every unit will see, large losses. But, you know, some of them are divisions that would automatically or already be scaling down things like mail workers. The IRS has largely been transitioning to, digital filing, but over half of that division is set to retire in the next couple of years. Important divisions, IT workers, and also, kind of their big units, things like agents and officers, the people who actually are going out and conducting the audits and collecting the money, answering the phones, are all going to see large losses over the next several years.
Okay, so everybody's favorite word, audit. When is it going to happen to me?
So it really depends who you are. The IRS has committed and said that this will only impact people who earn more than $400,000 a year, as well as large corporations. Republicans have disagreed with that number, and I've even talked to some tax experts who say it can be a little bit more complicated than just a bright line, here's income and they don't touch anything below that. However, there's going to be no immediate changes. It takes a long time both to hire people, get them trained to do this complex work, and actually start selecting tax returns for audit and seeing results. One tax lawyer estimates, you know, this could be 2026, 2027. It could be even longer before you really see that audit rate start to tick up.
Hey, Laura, just going back to what Joel said, I mean, this is how we help fund the government. So you would think this would be, fingers crossed, the most efficient or one of the most efficient, you know, organizations within the government. And yet it's also, you know, become a bit of a political football.
It really has, and that has really, you know, created a lot of problems for the agency. It means that it's harder for them to recruit workers. You know, it's a government agency. A lot of these people could go work in the private sector and make significantly more money. And the IRS also just announced that they're doing a security review of all of their facilities because of threats that have been coming into the agency. So you can see how this is going to be a big challenge for them. If you know, you got to convince people to come work for potentially less money, and you know, have a target on their forehead.
And so when we think about sort of this wave of employees that the IRS would like to hire, I mean, it's sort of similar to the aid that's coming in. It's not going to hit at once necessarily, like immediate relief. These employees have to be trained, I would assume.
Yeah, and for some of these employees, you know, to do these complex audits, which is kind of where the bulk of the revenue is going, it could take, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 years to really get people to the point where they can do this on their own. So this is a long-term investment, both in the people as well as the agency. And so that's why it's really going to, you know, it's not until almost a decade from now that you'll really see kind of all of that $80 billion put to work.
So, Laura, you know, the other element of this has been sort of the resistance that you read about that Republicans have for the IRS. And I'm curious, you hint at this, is that there have been some Republican representatives who have said, you know, we will roll this back and don't think that this is permanent. How realistic is that?
Well, there's a couple things that they'll need to do. One is they'll need to control both the House, the Senate, and the White House. So even, you know, if Republicans win big in the midterms, they still have, you know, Joe Biden to contend with in the White House. So it's not likely that in the next, you know, 2 years or so that they could do anything. But if, you know, in 2024, Republicans were to have a full sweep, they could start defunding and clawing back some of this money that's going in. Of course, you know, it gets a little bit trickier once, you know, the money's been in rotation for a couple years. If, you know, some of the things that Republicans like, you know, having better customer service, if you start to see results there, they may be hesitant for political purposes to pull all the money back. But it's certainly something that's possible, though, you know, unclear if or when that could happen.
Customer service would be nice. I'm just going to say a great story. And in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, you can read it in its entirety. Laura Davison, thank you so much. Congressional tax reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone in our Washington, D.C. bureau. And our thanks to Joel Weber as well. He is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine on the Access line from Massachusetts. We said it's in the upcoming issue, that new issue, out on newsstands on Thursday, also at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg terminal.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
stiefelnicholas.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Here we go, everybody. Just about 9 minutes left in today's trading session, driving towards the close. We are just off our lows of the session, but little change on both the S&P and the NASDAQ, as we just heard from Doug, down about 0.5% on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Here in studio with us, we welcome Ken Van Leeuwen, CEO, founder, and managing director of the wealth management firm Van Leeuwen & Company. He is, as we mentioned, here in our studio. Nice to have you here with Katie and myself. How are you?
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. We've been talking, of course, a lot about a big macro themes, but front and center is the passing of Julian Robertson. It is our most read story on the Bloomberg. 90 years old, a legend in the hedge fund industry. You're someone who's been in the investment world for a while. How do you think about it?
Well, Julian, while I had never met him, was always considered to be somewhat of an icon in the industry, a gentleman. He was from the South, so he embodied all of those ideals. And, of course, the legacy that he created with so many wonderful money managers, I believe they called them tiger cubs
they
underneath
did.
Him,
yeah.
Right? So many people learned so many great things, and he passed along his, quote-unquote, secrets to them, and now they continue to apply the trade, and probably their secrets are continuing to be passed on. So, and just, you know, a tremendous business person, philanthropist, gentleman, probably dad, mm-hmm. grandfather.
Right.
And if you think about, he was known as a stock picker, and he was known for not risking more than 5% of capital on one bet. And I feel like that's advice that applies pretty neatly to, you know, this sort of environment that we're in right now.
Oh, totally. I mean, because even in our own shop right now, when we're managing assets, right, we're not taking, well, we never, because we're fiduciaries, you can't take bigger than 5% positions. So the you know, you're taking little positions because you're really not sure what's working and what's not, because as we're seeing, it can turn on a dime and it can turn instantaneously. And today you have a loss, tomorrow you have a positive, or, vice versa.
Like Julian, you are a stock picker and you do, though, take some positions, leading you to, at least at this point, healthcare, staples, and telecom. Those are your big three areas that you're finding opportunities, or at least allocating new money?
Correct. I mean, what we're doing is we're looking especially like at a couple companies like TJ Maxx. I think still, is anything recession-proof? What's a recession? That hasn't been defined yet. But TJ Maxx is considered a bargain hunter's paradise, so people of all income streams will go to a TJ Maxx. So we like that very much. It's a very well-run company in off-price retailing, because right now they're getting some tremendous buys in the market. We like them. They're well-positioned. We like healthcare, because healthcare, again, is one of those areas that can weather the storm.
We have been talking a lot about healthcare, I feel like, since the Inflation Reduction Act, and there's initiatives in there. But I just feel like, you know, Amazon and others pursuing a company, we just feel like there's a lot going on in the healthcare space right now.
Especially health insurance, right? Because health insurance like United Health, mm-hmm. Elevance Health, I mean, these are some really strong financial companies with big market positions. And people pay their premiums, for lack of a better word.
So TJ Maxx, healthcare, health insurance, we like those. What are you avoiding right now? What doesn't look good?
Of course, anything gold-related right now, miners in particular, we're avoiding.
Interesting.
Why? Because we don't see them right now. You know, like if you look at the gold, just the GLD, it hasn't performed well at all, even during this quote-unquote inflationary environment that we've had. It's not working. So why be there? Okay? So that's an area that we're not in. Thankfully, we were able to come out of a little bit of energy. We're slowly inching back into energy.
You are.
Yeah. We like energy.
Don't fight the energy trade, basically.
Don't fight it because, you know, hey, look, as we go towards the end of the year, and we have to remember it's already going to be September in a couple of weeks.
That's right.
We're trying to forget that.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's pretty remarkable, right?
Right. We're going to start to, you know, people are going to want to show up at the end of the year with things that have worked in their portfolios. So energy has clearly worked this year.
Snap-on Tool Company. It's so funny. Money managers come in here and they're like, a lot of them talk about this name. What specifically about it?
It's, first of all, just right, it's that handyman specialty. It's that small contractor, the guy who's busy, the convenience of Snap-on. Remember, they bring the tools to your site. You don't have to
The trucks.
You don't have to go to your hardware store or order them. They come right to you. And it's a tremendously well-run company. They just increased their dividend a little bit ago. And those are companies we look for, right, that are economically healthy, that are raising their dividends and have the confidence to do so going forward, you know, because we hear about what the CEOs are thinking about the, you know, the next 6 months, 9 months, year.
So you care when a company comes out and reports their earnings and they say, we're maintaining our dividend, we're raising our dividend, we're doing buybacks. That is certainly something you take into consideration?
Very much so. Mm. Very much so. Dividend health and dividend increases are a big player to us. I mean, those are stocks we're focusing on, too, that increase dividends.
What about the fixed income market? Do you see any opportunities there as we talk about dividends and that consistent cash flow?
We continue to like the muni market. Okay. We liked muni high yields because we still think that tax-advantaged income is going to be good for a lot of people. It sold off, honestly, substantially earlier in the year, so much so, if we remember, we look back at the analyst Whitman. I think she basically talked about how munis were going to go broke, and they sold off tremendously. That was the buying opportunity in the spring, was in municipal bonds, honestly.
All right, we're going to have to leave it on that note. Thank you so much. Good to talk names with you. Really appreciate it. And come back soon.
You got it. Thank you for your time.
Ken Van Leeuwen, CEO, founder, and managing director of Van Leeuwen & Company, joining us here in our Interactive Broker studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.